Welcome to each one that's here this afternoon. I was just thinking as I was standing here, probably some of you could do a better job of explaining some of these, what's gone on in history, but we'll try to get a few things here. As I was thinking about these classes of today, tomorrow, and the next day, I feel a little bit like I used to as a boy, standing on the edge of a pond or a lake, and here's a big expanse of water, no way to plumb the depths of that, and I'd take a little round stone and just go like that, and it'd skip across, get to the other side, and that's about all we're going to be able to do. It just hit a few points, and that's going to be about all. In this handout, on the second page is what hopefully we can get covered today. Have somewhat of an outline of the things we'd like to cover. And then there's some other charts and so on behind that. The first, of course, is Europe. And I don't know how many of you are acquainted with with Europe. Of course, the map that you have before you is not the same map as what we're talking in the 1500s. There's quite a difference there, but it's the same landmass, but divided up different geographically. For example, I'll just point that out right now. To the left in the middle, you see Germany, and to the right of that is the Czech Republic. In the Czech Republic is Moravia. I mean, Moravia was out of that, the eastern part of that. And I've often kind of wondered, you know, where did the Hutterites go to? Well, it was to Moravia here, which is Czech Republic today. So I would like to be able to take questions. If you have a question as I ramble along and it's not making sense, go ahead and raise your hand, interrupt, however you expect your students to do in school. And because we can, I'll just keep talking if you don't interrupt me. That's just kind of the way I do here. So, all right. So first of all, on our outline is an introduction, which is the value of history. Now, to some people, history is very boring. And why even look at it? But you know, there is so much that we can learn from history. After the Apostle Paul recounted the events of the children of Israel when they went through the wilderness journeys in 1 Corinthians 10:11, he says, "Now all these things happened to them for examples, and they are written for our admonition." So what kind of admonition can we receive from history? And I guess more and more, as I have been involved in church administration, there are situations that come up. Oh, now, has the church ever faced this before? And if they have, how has it been dealt with or worked through? And so what has happened in the past is so much of a guiding beacon, either for or against. I mean, there's some good and some not so good. So church history helps us to understand the present and how to move forward in the present. I think it motivates us to understand what's going on. And it gives us courage to go on. And you know, actually, church history helps us to interpret Bible doctrine. Now, that's interesting. And we're not going to be able to get into just a lot of Bible doctrine today, but hopefully a little bit, because that's what this is all about. I'd like to give you a Bible story, that portrays to us the importance of knowing history. And I'm thinking of one of the judges by the name of Jephthah. And you know, the more I think about Jephthah, the more I'm impressed with his character, with his background. You know, he was a son of a harlot. And so he was looked down upon by his brethren. But somebody, somewhere, taught that man some things. I don't know who it was. Was it his father? Was it his mother? Was it his priest? I don't know. But there come a time when the king of Ammon wanted to fight against Israel. And so his brethren called him back, and he decided to come and help them. So I'm going to read just a little bit from Judges. Let's see. Get my Bible out here. Judges 11. Just a few verses here. Beginning with verse 12. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, What hast thou to do with me that thou art come against me to fight in my land? And the king of the children of Ammon answered unto the messengers of Jephthah, Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt, from Arnon even unto Jabbok, and unto Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands again peaceably. Now if you have a Bible atlas, Jabbok, let's see, Arnon. It was just about in the middle of the Dead Sea, and below that was Moab. Right above that is the tribe of Reuben. And so this king of, and to the east of Reuben, and I think it was Manasseh, are the Amorites there. Okay, so in verse 14, Jephthah sent messengers again unto the king of the children of Ammon, and said unto him, Thus saith Jephthah, Israel took not away the land of Moab, nor the land of the children of Ammon. But when Israel came up from Egypt and walked through the wilderness under the Red Sea, and came to Kadesh, and then he goes on and he recounts how that they skirted that whole area. We didn't take it from you. We took it from the Amalekites, not from the Ammonites. And then he tells the king of Ammon, he said, now listen, you have no right to ask for this land. We've had it for 300 years. If it was yours, why did you come get it before now? I'm going to read verses 26 and 27. While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns and in Aroer and her towns and all the cities that be along by the coast of Arnon 300 years, why therefore did ye not recover them within that time? Wherefore I have not sinned against thee, but thou doest me wrong to war against me. The Lord the judge be judged this day between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. You know, if Jephthah had not known the history. Now Jephthah, according to my Bible, lived about 260 years after Joshua, after the land was divided. That is longer than it's been since George Washington was president. Somehow or another, Jephthah knew his history, and he put it to practice, and if it had not been that he knew the history, I'm not sure how that would have gone. Okay. So now let's go to our history in Europe a little bit more. Point number two is a spiritual climate in Europe in the early 16th century. Politically, I think you are well aware that most of Europe was under the control of Rome or the Catholic Pope. And it was not just religiously, but it was also politically. And he basically ruled as king and sole monarch of Europe. So the Catholic Church was corrupt. It was greedy of wealth. It had many, many unscriptural practices, which we don't have time to enumerate all those this afternoon. And so after the printing press came and people began to read the scriptures for themselves and to read the writings of others, they begin to realize that what was going on in the Catholic Church was not scriptural. It was not what God intended for his people, and there got to be a lot of unrest. Most of you are probably aware of Martin Luther, who was a reformer in Germany. He founded a church. And then in our lesson here today, we think of another reformer, of Ulrich Zwingli. And Ulrich Zwingli was an interesting man. He was a dynamic preacher. He believed the scriptures, He taught the scriptures. He saw what ought to be done. But you see, a lot of these reformers were trying to do what reform means. They were trying to reform the Catholic Church and make the Catholic Church what it ought to be. Well, soon it became apparent that they'd have to make a break from the Catholic Church. So Ulrich Zwingli began to change his position, basically because he felt he needed to obey the council of the city of Zurich. They were asking that he not move too fast in replacing the mass and some of those things. Well, there were several young men who were students of his that were zealous, and they wanted to see changes. They knew that changes needed to come, and they could hardly believe it that Master Zwingli was not following what he had said before. It's interesting. Have any of you ever been to Zurich there at the Grossmünster? Oh, well, then I guess I've got something over on the rest of you. Interesting place. Well, I guess Joel's been there. To see where Zwingli preached. And it's quite a cathedral. And we visited there as a family in 05, so it's been quite a while ago. So we decided to just sing there in this church, this cathedral. I guess you'd call it a cathedral. And it was kind of strange. It was our family, and we had a guide, Lewis Overholt, and we sang there. Well, people started coming in, tourists, you know, and they sat down. Well, here's a music presentation. We'll sit here and hear what's going on. And but it was really meaningful to me. And you know, his pulpit was not here. His pulpit was hanging on the wall. That's where he preached from, and it's still there today. All right. So these men that were students of his, they were very well. I think Mons, Felix Mons would have known Hebrew, and maybe taught that. They went from house to house and had Bible studies and various things. People were really becoming interested in the gospel, in the true gospel. And so these, I mentioned three of them here, Conrad Grebel, Felix Mons, George Blaurock. There were others. There was Simon Stumpf. There was, I should be able to list off some others. But they were looking not just to reform the church. They were not looking to appease the city council, but they were looking to establish a New Testament church, a church that was based on the New Testament. And so they were willing to give their all for the cause. All right. Now, if you will turn to the next page, the Schleitheim Confession of Faith. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these confessions, but I'd like for us to realize that these men didn't just start a new movement so they could get together with their friends and have a picnic lunch. That's not what this was all about. There were some very definite spiritual truths that they were interested in. So we have here the Schleitheim Confession written about 2 years after, well, I should back up, the beginning of the, what we consider the beginning of the Swiss Brethren, the Anabaptist movement, was in January of 1525 when they were meeting together trying to decide what to do because Ulrich Zwingli was not doing what they thought he was going to do, and they finally decided to baptize one another, and that was the beginning, and they were called then Anabaptist, which is a rebaptized. So there got to be so many different ideas. There was no central head. There was nobody to give direction, different things, and so there was a tendency to become fanatical on some of these things. So finally, some brethren got together and said, we need to decide what is the basis that we believe in. And so this Schleitheim Confession I have here the movement of the Anabaptists was threatened with many different views and practices. This confession was written to outline the basic points in which the brethren took a stand opposed to the Reformed Church. Now, this is not a total confession of faith. This was more the areas where they found a difference between them and the Catholic Church and Zwingli and so on. We have baptism, the ban or excommunication, the breaking of bread, that would have to do with the Mass, separation from the world and from the practices of the apostate church, pastors in the church, the sword and the oath. These are things that they needed to face. I think you're probably aware that the Swiss were severely persecuted. Some of them were executed, some were banished, some were whipped, and one of the worst punishments was being sold as oarsmen. Anybody know what that was? They would be put on galley slaves, or they were sold as galley slaves. They would go out on the sea and just day after day to row those boats, and probably never saw home again. So because of that, then, because of that, they begin to seek refuge in other places. Now, before that, here on point four, we were talking about Zurich, but there's other cantons, and especially Bern. And I think a lot of our Mennonite people would have background that would go back to Bern, and probably some of your ancestors would have moved from Bern maybe to the Platinum, Alsace, Lorraine, wherever. The canton of Bern is interesting. They were very harsh in trying to suppress the Anabaptists. Oh, let's see. Maybe I have time for a little story. When we toured over there in Switzerland, we went to a village by the name of Trub. And this would be the home area of the Swartzen Trubers. And right there is, there was a sign that says Hinderhutten. And that is the cottage out back. And that is where there was a barn that when the Anabaptist hunters would come from the city of Bern, they would try to apprehend the Anabaptists, and they would run into this barn, and there was a board that was set up in such a way that it would tip, they would slide in. There was a little compartment there that had been part of a smoke room from that house, and that's where the Anabaptists hid until finally their hiding place was caught. The father in that home, the wife was an Anabaptist. I think he eventually was, but he was arrested because of that, and he was sent to the Jura Mountains. And so, finally, nobody knows for sure what became of him, but there is record that he was arrested at one point. And what happened was, he was in a house that was just right on the border of the canton of Bern and the canton of Luzerne. And so the authorities came in to arrest him. Whoops! They couldn't take him because when he came, it was a Cantonese officials, but he was actually in the canton of Luzerne, in that part of the house, and they couldn't arrest him. So that was kind of an interesting thing. I won't charge you any extra for that story. All right. So these Anabaptists begin to go to different places, and I've listed a few. The Platinum, Tyrol, which is today Austria, Moravia, which I said is Czech Republic today, and that's where the Hutterites went. South Germany, Alsace, Lorraine. And so these, they went as poor people. Some of them were crippled, some of them were older people, but they went to try to find a place where they would have at least a measure of freedom. And this is where a lot of, and I don't know what all your backgrounds are, but this is where a lot of our forefathers would have immigrated from. I have two grandfathers, a great-grandfather, and a great-great-grandfather that immigrated from the Alsace-Lorraine area. Some as boys, some as older men. But that's where my roots are. So in our trip over there, it was really interesting. We had a guide that took us through France in Alsace and Lorraine. And he had a little information ahead, and he showed us villages where my ancestors had lived. So we went to a village of Lindstroff, and he said, "No, let's go in here." Went into the we went into the, I guess what you'd say, the city hall, and it opened up a cupboard, and there was probably a wall almost as from side to side here, just full of books. And he looked there, and I forget what was it, I forget what the date was. Okay, right here. And so he took that book out, we went and opened it up. He had checked it out ahead of time. And here was a written record of the death of my great-great-great-grandfather, Lindstroff. It was a village. I've got a copy of that at home. And I don't know a lot about my great-great-grandfather, but he attested to that death by an X. I guess he couldn't write. I'm not sure. So just interesting things that are still available to search out. All right. The Jura Mountains, that's a little bit interesting. That's, I think, the Anabaptists were allowed to live anywhere above the 3,000 foot level. It was harsh living. It was hard to eke out a living. And so they did that. And if I understand right, the Swiss cheese was started by some of the Anabaptist farmers. That's where the recipe for the Swiss cheese came from. And then there were some. I have an H there basically to show, because we'll talk a little bit about some of the people that come from Russia to America. There were actually some Swiss. It wasn't just all Dutch. And so then we go to, how are we doing here? We go to the Amish in Europe. There was a, now let's just look a little bit at our at the chart here. If you notice here, we've got the kind of the Mennonite stream through here. Up here is the Amish. We've kind of covered up to about here, maybe. And you see there's a long way to go here. Here's the Swiss Brethren began, and the Dutch Anabaptists, which I want to get to just next here. Some of the world events there. Probably I'll talk a lot more about this chart tomorrow, but we do want to talk about the Dordrecht Confession of Faith. And here in 1597 was the last Dutch martyr, in 1614 the last Swiss martyr. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But you know, when we were over there and visiting, we went to the church where my great-grandfather was minister, ordained minister. And I kind of thought, you know, maybe I'd see some quaint old church building and that he would have gone to. Well, it was a modern building in the city of Basel, Switzerland. I asked somebody, I said, "Well, what about this?" Oh, they said the Mennonites could not have meeting houses before 1900. So anything prior to that, they would have had to meet in houses or barns or whatever. So there was still persecution, even though no martyrdom. All right, now let's go to the Amish division. There was a to get to this, you kind of have to jump ahead to the Dutch, which I want to talk about next. But the Dutch had a confession of faith, the Dordrecht Confession of Faith, that got circulated in Alsace and in Switzerland, and the Mennonites there pretty well accepted it as their own statement of faith. There was a young, zealous bishop by the name of Jacob Ammon that believed that this was the original statement of the Swiss Brethren, but he was in error on that. The two things probably that he would have really zeroed in on was feet washing and the ban, avoidance. And so he called for meetings of the different elders of the churches, and they came, and he was insistent that the way that he saw things were the way it ought to be. And there were some of the other men, Hans Reis was the one that opposed him the most, I guess. They said, no, that's not the way things should be done. And so there got to be two factions. Ended up with the Mennonites on one side and the Amish on the other. Some of the issues that brought division was avoidance or the ban. And that still follows the Amish today, which you're probably aware. There was a woman that lied. And she was in the, I think, in the church of Hans Reist. And she confessed that. But Jacob Ammon felt that the church was too lax in discipline, and he insisted that Hans Reist excommunicate that woman, and he refused. And so that got to be a point of contention. There were people who were very helpful to the Anabaptists. They were called halfway Anabaptists. And they would warn the people when the Anabaptist hunters were coming. And so they were very helpful to the people. And some of the prayers that they had, I should have dug that out. But it would indicate that the Lord would reward them throughout eternity. And Jacob Ammon says, no. He says, how can they be saved if they are not willing to take a stand and follow the Lord in this life? See, they were sympathetic to the Anabaptists, but they wouldn't take that position. So that was another issue. Other issues was communion twice a year instead of once. The practice of feet washing, that's interesting. And the Swiss churches, I don't know if they ever did that. Garments should be closed with hooks and eyes, and the beard should not be trimmed. And the Amish were mainly in Alsace and the Platina churches. I mentioned that we toured there in France in the Alsace-Lorraine area, and our guide was the secretary of the Mennonite churches in France. He told me, he says, there's 22 churches in France. And he said, all but two of those have Amish background. There are two that have been Mennonite all the way through, but today they're Mennonite. All right, so anyhow, now we want to go on and talk a little bit about what happened in Holland. Any questions? I mean, I've just been rambling. I probably haven't covered what you wanted to hear. All right. So we go then to the Anabaptists in Holland, and that is such a confusion. I've read that account again and again, what all went on, and there was this person and that person and another person, and finally out of that comes some sense. And that's so when I taught this in Bible school, I made a chart, which would be the next one, to give a little bit of a line of direction of these different people. And I'm not going to go into it a whole lot. I want to talk just a little bit about Melker Hoffman, because there were the Melkerites. But what's interesting is that Martin Luther would have ordained Melker Hoffman for preaching. And then he would have, Melker Hoffman would have baptized and I think maybe ordained as John Tripmaker, which is a, what is that? Slipper maker or shoemaker or something. And then he would have baptized John Matthews, and then we have the one going off to the one side and one to the other and on down. But the ones that we really are interested in is toward the bottom, Dirk Phillips, Obie Phillips, and Menno Simons. So Hoffman was a very gifted speaker, and he could sway the crowds. I have here that he baptized 300 people in 1530. Now, keep in mind, this was when baptism of adults was not the norm. It was not the accepted thing. But part of Melker Hoffman's problem was, a lot of his problem was, he was a visionary. He was fanatical. He followed things of prophecy. He took the word of a woman who had a vision that he was the prophet Elijah that was to come. He accepted that. So then, if you follow here, there's over the one side, this John of Leyden, he became the king of Munster. And Munster is a very sad, very unfortunate situation. And there were some ungodly men who posed as being appointed of God to rule the city. And so there was much suffering and starvation. And for years there were those who said, you know, that's Anabaptism. That is what Anabaptism leads to, is that type of thing. And I can't go into all of the Munsterism, but you've probably read about that. So then Obie and Dirk Phillips were baptized and actually became Melkerites. But they were soon disillusioned. They saw something's not right here. This is not biblical, what was going on. And they realized they had been deceived. And so Obie would like to have just run from the whole thing. But he said, I saw these people as sheep without a shepherd. And I just felt I needed to help them. Now what's sad is, see, Obie then would have eventually ordained Menno Simons as an elder, and then a couple years after that, he kind of faded off the scene. He got tired of the battle, got tired of the Catholics on one side, the fanaticism on the other. He just gave it up. Menno, I think, would have labeled him as a demon, that he had forsaken them. But anyhow, Obie and Dirk, they formed a fellowship, became known as the Obanites. And this was I guess today we would say it was a true Anabaptist group. And if you'll notice here on, there's about 8 years difference between the Swiss Brethren and the Dutch Anabaptists. Not any relationship back and forth. They both came to the conclusions that they did by studying the Bible and putting it to practice. And so Menno Simons was a priest. He was converted. He joined the Obanites and he was ordained elder. And Menno was a very strong leader. And he helped to direct the Dutch Anabaptists away from fanaticism. He was a hunted man. His life was in danger. And there was a bounty set on him. If somebody could turn him in, there would be a reward. And anybody that sheltered him for a night, their head was in danger. So the Dutch Anabaptists, because of his strong leadership, became known as Mennonites, I guess it would be, on later Mennonites. So the Anabaptist churches were in Netherlands and in Flanders, which is today is Belgium, and North Germany. In Flanders or Belgium, they were so severely persecuted it basically wiped them out to where there were no Anabaptists anymore in Belgium. And so we have here the last of the Dutch martyrs in 1597. I think a lot of the stories in the Martyr's Mirror would have happened in Holland. And terrible persecution. But finally they were granted religious freedom. And the Mennonites were very industrious. They became good businessmen. They became wealthy, which probably was not to their spiritual gain. And they, through that, they became very helpful to their Swiss brethren. They got in contact with them when there were those who would go to, say, Alsace, a pitiful group of people, and they would appeal to the Mennonites in Holland. They'd send them money, and finally, the Mennonites in Holland said, "This is enough. We've done all we can. We have to let you go." But then they come through again, and they used their money in a very good way. But through that, they lost their distinct identity. They were more and more assimilated by the society in which they lived. They established seminaries with trained pastors and so on. All right, now let's go there to point eight. Right to begin with, there were some that fled to the Danzig area. If you want to look on the map here, you see Poland, and right up there, kind of at the tip, is Gdansk, right by the Baltic Sea. And I don't know if they went cross country or if they went up around Denmark to get there, but probably within 10 years, less than 10 years, the beginning of the Anabaptists in Holland, a number of them had fled to Danzig, which is now a part of Poland. And that got to be a huge Mennonite settlement. I think it's there's a plaque there on the Hublin church that says that the Mennonites lived here from, I think it's 1340 to 1945. That's over 400 years that they were in that area. And they were basically moved out or wiped out in World War II. I think it's the Mennonites in Europe that states that there are 10,000 Mennonites in that general area. And that would have been written before World War II. Today, there might be one or two there. But they were wiped out. Okay. So, they were very useful to the local authorities. They knew how to drain swamps. They knew how to put up windmills. They came from Holland. And they, so there was the Vistula Delta that was swampy and so on, and they drained it with their windmills and made that a very productive area. So they were very much appreciated. Now, I have in here, this is kind of like just inserted, you might say. But there was a very severe conflict on point nine. The Friesen-Flemish conflict. And I think it's good just to mention that because that followed the Dutch Mennonites for years, for centuries, even on into Russia, this conflict between the Friesens and the Flemish. The Friesens would have been from Holland. The Flemish, of course, were from Belgium. When they were persecuted in Belgium, those Flemish moved to Holland. And the Flemish were they liked fine clothes. They were weavers. They liked good food. And they were quick-tempered, and they were emotional. Now, the Friesens, on the other hand, were a little more reserved. They didn't show their feelings so much, not as open with their anger. But when they were aroused, they didn't easily forget if they felt they'd been wronged. And they, on the other hand, they didn't wear such fine clothes, but they had nice houses. And they had goods and linens. And well, then the Frisians looked at the Flemish and said, look at their fine clothes. The Flemish looked at the Frisians and said, well, look at their fine houses. And there got to be a rift between them. About 5 years after the death of Menno Simons, the rift became very acute. There were two leaders that were called in to mediate, to see if they could get this thing together. And over the centuries, there were a number of meetings to try to do this. But this one I'm just going to tell you about. So there were two leaders that came in, and they just tried to figure this whole thing out. So they finally called everybody again and said, okay, here is what it is, and this is what it's going to take to fix, and everything looked good. So now they said, you Frisians, you need to kneel and ask for forgiveness for the error that you've had. So the Frisians, they knelt down and they prayed and they asked for forgiveness and they got up. Okay, now the Flemish, you also need to kneel and ask for forgiveness. So the Flemish, they knelt and asked for forgiveness. And when they were about ready to get up, they said, no, just a minute. Now the Frisians, they will help you up because you had the most wrong in this matter. Guess what happened? People that were very prone to anger. And that just really divided them for centuries. I mean, not just that thing, but... So I have here the Dordrecht Confession of Faith. And we have that right over here. And that was a meeting of the... it was a peace meeting, trying to come to an agreement where these two groups could come together. The big thing was the ban or avoidance. And, you know, it carried just through again and again. If there was a man that was excommunicated, his wife wasn't supposed to live with him. Just very, very strong that way. And so this was held as a peace conference. And it was written in such a way that they seemed like both sides, even though they weren't 100% good with it, they could agree to it. And as a result, there's the 18 Articles of Faith, which I have listed there. I don't think we'll go into that. But what's interesting to me is that we even... I don't know how you're about your churches, but we, as our church, we still subscribe to the doctrines that are listed in the Dordrecht Confession of Faith. All right. Now let's go just a little bit to Prussia, which is today is Poland. That was a German state, and there's a lot of reasons why they were becoming dissatisfied there. There was not land for all the sons that were coming and so on. So the Catherine the Great in Russia offered that the Mennonites could come and they could have religious freedom. They could have freedom for forever, to have their own schools. They could run their own villages and so on. And so there were several migrations starting from 1789 to 1870. So there's what, about 90 years there, I guess? No, 80 years? And there were two that were begin with. One is known as the Old Colony. And here again, if you look on the map, and I don't have it exactly, I should have looked for sure, but the first two were located in Ukraine. That was under Russia at the time. And then the next two, which was quite a bit later, they, I think, are kind of off the side of the map here a little bit, about 500 miles northeast of Korkisa. And so there were four main colonies. And I did not realize that till I was doing some work on this here, but if, as near as I could find out, the Russian government had said they would give 170 acres to a family. That could not be divided. So the oldest son would get that land. What's going to happen? They had 8, 10, 12 children. What's going to happen with the other sons? What are they going to do? So they had a lot of landless people. What do they do? So then there were other colonies that started from the landless. And there were around 50 more colonies started from those four original ones. And that brings us into huge migrations when things went a little bit wrong there in Russia, particularly the Bolshevik Revolution and some of those things. One thing I might mention yet before I let you go, the last sheet here I find interesting. We're talking about the Europe and the spread of Anabaptism. You can see where the Anabaptists were in Germany at that point. I have to get my right down here is Switzerland, and you see it kind of went northeast from there, large area, clear over to Bavaria here, and then the Dutch Anabaptists here at Holland. There was quite a few in this area. Then clear up here, Holstein, that's where Menno Simons would have spent his last days, quite a number there. Then you go clear over to the upper right-hand corner and over in the Danzig area is a huge settlement. So it's, to me, this, and then over Moravia, clear over there, that's where the Hutterites went. Kind of an interesting map. Quite a bit different than the map of Europe today. Any questions? All right. I think the time has come that you need to go to your next class. So thank you for coming. And yeah, look at that. Just right on the money here. All right. Thank you very much. Enjoyed having you here.